Arcade. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, g'day, Blokes and Sheilas. Folks, here we are. It's Thursday over there, isn't it? It's Friday morning here already, and I think things are a bit hot, so we're going to try and sort that out. Man, we got tons to go through today. It's been a hell of a morning trying to get my head around the news. I got to tell you. Let's see if this cleans things up a little bit. Sorry about the game swapping around here on you folks, but this is engineering on the fly. What are you going to do? Welcome aboard, everybody. Welcome to Head On with Bob Kincaid. I am your honored fill-in host, Mr. John Fox, coming to you from the beautiful, wonderful world of Central Coast, Australia, in New South Wales. And, man, we got a lot to go on today. And starting off with some fairly kind of sad news. Now, one was unexpected and one's not really a surprise, but Farrah Fawcett passed away after a long battle with, even saying it sounds really rough, anal cancer. I mean, I don't know if you can really kind of think about anything quite as horrible as that. And also Michael Jackson. And it appears that he's committed suicide by reports. He was found not breathing in his home, and they couldn't revive him, and it appears as though he took sleeping pills. Now, confirmation on this is still a bit sketchy, but Huffington Post is reporting it, TMZ is reporting it, Michael had his problems, but you can't deny the impact that he had on music, and hopefully we'll be able to play some stuff from him later on in the show. It'd be interesting to see what folks find out about that, because he's been a troubled guy over the last few years. I mean, he hasn't actually made any money for a record label in over a decade. He's in extreme debt. All the legal troubles that he had, for a while, the only income that he had was actually because of the Beatles catalog that he partially owned. I don't want to actually be negative on the guy, considering that he's passed, but it became one of the great stories of the excess of the modern music industry where the machine around him, anytime he put out an album, was so unbelievably expensive that no amount of record sales could possibly have covered the costs. And, you know, hey, but, a legend musically, it's a sad loss for the music industry in many ways, but I think he was a pretty troubled guy there at the end, which is really sad. I'm a bit taken back by it. I didn't quite expect for him to go and take his own life, but these are the things that happen. I've got so much to try and get to today, and I had to actually do a reboot right before the show, and so I'm still getting kind of my stories up and happening here. So, but I actually want to start off with Iran today, if y'all don't mind. you know, things are just kind of developing at this incredible rate. And, you know, we were talking about yesterday how, you know, with the fact that the mainstream media has been cut out of the picture, we really don't know what's going on, even though if the mainstream media was there, we'd have other issues of context to try and deal with. But I would imagine that a lot of you have actually been following on with Nico Pitney's live blogging at the Huffington Post, which has really been rather extraordinary. And something caught my eye when I was going through things. And, wow, there's a lot been added since I last loaded this page. Bloody hell. There may be a compromise kind of coming in the works. There's the and again, you know, so many of these reports are so hard to confirm that you know, you really don't know what to believe. However, Raza Aslan from the Daily Beast, who's probably had some of the best sourcing throughout this whole situation, says here, reliable sources in Iran are suggesting that a possible compromise to put an end to the violent uprising that has rocked Iran for the past 2 weeks may be in the works. I've previously reported that the second most powerful man in Iran, Ayatollah Hashemi, Rafsanjani, is the head of the Assembly of Experts, the body with the power to choose or dismiss the supreme leader. He's in the city of Qom, the country's religious center, trying to rally enough votes from his fellow assembly members to remove the current supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, from power. News out of Iran suggests that he may be succeeding. At the very least, it seems he may have gained enough support from the clerical establishment to force a compromise from the Ayatollah, one that would entail a runoff election between Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and his main reformist rival, Hussein Mousavi. Now, that could very possibly be the big turning point in all of this. And it might just go to prove, you know, the people shouldn't be afraid of their government. The government should be afraid of the people. And, you know, over the last few days, we've been seeing them. We've been seeing the establishment over there grasping at straws in amazing ways. Especially those what appeared to me to be the kind of coerced, put up admissions of guilt from quote unquote opposition supporters. And I mean, you watch these things and they just look like a complete joke. I mean, when you hear in this day and age that, you know, someone saying, you know, we were compelled to riot and loot because of the BBC and Voice of America Radio? I mean, really? Really, 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 really? And, I mean, this just appears to be a government, you know, grasping at straws, looking for anything to divert attention from what it is that they're doing. And you know, when Bruce and I were having the chat yesterday, you know, he said, look, you know, he said this whole thing about the senator's affairs in South Carolina were overshadowing the news and of what was coming out of Iran, and you know, I agreed with that, but then I was kind of thinking a little bit after the show. The other part of it though too is the rallies had been pulled back, so there wasn't quite as much coming out of Iran over the last couple of days. In fact, last night, Rachel Maddow was saying, you know, this was the first day in 12 that Iran didn't lead her show. And But the scary thing is that it appears again, you know, we can't confirm these things. This is what makes this whole thing fascinating in some ways, and troublesome in other ways. The violence has been increasing. And it's just, you know, it's really looking rather dire over there. Now, another thing that popped up on Pitney's live blogging here was at 8 minutes past 2 Eastern Time. BBC's John Simpson, whose visa expired on Sunday, writes today of the secret voices in Iran. For reasons best not explained, I've come to know a former member of the Revolutionary Guards real well. He's done some pretty dreadful things in his life, from attacking women in the streets for not wearing the full Islamic gear to fighting alongside Islamic revolutionaries in countries abroad. And yet now, in the tumult that has gripped Iran since its election last week, he has had a change of heart. He's become a backer of Mir Hussein Mosavi, the reformist candidate who alleges fraud in the elections. He saved up the money to send his son to a private school abroad, and he loathes President Ahmadinejad, and he's not the only one. I had to leave Iran last Sunday when the authorities refused to renew my visa, but before I left, another former senior Revolutionary Guard member came to our hotel to see us. Remember me, he pleaded? Remember that I helped the BBC? I realize that even a person so intimately linked to the Islamic Revolution thinks that something will soon change in Iran. I mean, I really think that this thing's coming to a head. I do believe. And, I mean, it sounds so wrong for me to say that this is fascinating. You know, it makes me think of this Tool song, Vicarious, you know. I need to watch people die from a good, safe distance. You know, this is a very fly on the wall kind of situation, and it's troubling. It's troubling, in you know, but for some reason, I'm looking at it that maybe we are going to see some real change, and hopefully not with the United States and Western meddling. Huh. We have a call.
Some reason.
Hi, you're on Head On. Who we got?
It's Susan.
Hey, Susan.
Yeah, I don't know if Michael Justice actually dead or not. MSNBC is saying he's in a coma.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Huh. Well, you know, I mean, we're seeing various different reports, but okay, I mean, I really would hope that, you know, it's not true, but interesting, because now over at the Political Carnival, Betsy sent this over to me, but they've updated saying that there are conflicting reports. Apparently,
yeah.
Okay. Because I've reloaded this page just recently. So they're saying that he's been hospitalized in Los Angeles after suffering a heart attack. The 50-year-old king of pop collapsed at his home around noon today. Staffers immediately rushed to his aid, but he was unresponsive. The call came in because the person was not breathing, says a spokesman for the Los Angeles City Fire Department. When the team arrived, they saw that CPR was already in progress by someone at the home. The person not breathing was transported to UCLA Medical Center and remains there. He had a heart attack, Father Joe Jackson tells E! News. He is not okay. His mother is on the way to the hospital now to check on him. Okay, so if this would be pretty horrible if it's being falsely reported. And go ahead.
I'm glad I reported it the way I did. I said he had been reported dead. I did not say he was dead. I just linked to a story saying that he had been reported. And since that was a TMZ link, they're updating.
Right. Okay, because, well, I tell you what, it's going to then start, it's going to add one more of my gripes with the Huffington Post. Because they've got it right at the top of their page. But they're taking it, they're taking it from TMZ. And it appears that TMZ isn't, redacting anything. How confusing. And
yeah, OMG is saying he is gone. Dad, guys, will you make up your mind?
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, if
CNN
if,
is only saying he's been taken to the hospital.
Hmm. Well, I guess we're gonna have to keep an eye on this, but you know, it would make you know. It's amazing how these things happen in threes. And we've had Ed McMahon, Farrah Fawcett,
yeah.
And
now him.
Yeah. This is, I guess, one of those problems of the modern media. But, hey, you know, even before the Internet, people did get things wrong. Cobbs is saying MSNBC says he's in a coma.
Yeah.
Huh.
That's what I was looking at. MSNBC said, you know, I had a Chiron on saying he was in a coma at some L.A. hospital. But the main reason I was calling is because what you were talking about in Iran.
Okay.
You know, the media that's been uploaded. Up on the video section there of the main page on Head On.
Yeah.
There is a piece of video. It's a slideshow that somebody, let's face it, people are going to start sending, people are now setting these things to music. There's called an Iran Invincible photo stream.
Right, I see it there.
Watch it, people. Watch it. It'll make little hairs stand up on the back of your head.
Well, did you see a couple of days ago, Rachel Maddow showed a bit of video from the BBC's Farsi language website where the protesters overran the Basiji?
Yeah.
And
yeah, they hunted him down.
Well, but there were where there was actually, you know, kind of a confrontation on the street, and they absolutely this wasn't just, you know, going after one or two people, but this was like an entire, you know, group of them being completely overrun. And, you know, I mean, this, I think this just that gives you such a great idea of the scale of this thing that's going on. And when I was talking to Cassie yesterday, I think one of the factors in all of this that cannot be discounted is the fact that 70% of the Iranian population is under 25 years old.
Yeah. Now, another video just below the invisible one that's really important is called Solidarity. And that ties in with a request by Mousavi to release green balloons. There's a request by people in Iran. There's a request, I don't know if it's from the people of Iran, to the American World Cup team to wear green wristbands.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw
but
that.
You can go to their site and ask them to.
Right. Okay. Okay. That's probably a really good idea. And I actually have a request of people out there. My good friend Anthony Lowenstein, who wrote this great book, My Israel Question, and his current book is called The Blogging Revolution. He's in New York. He's in New York at the moment, spending a few months in the States, and I have a feeling he's going to end up based there. He's been trying to make contact with Rachel Maddow. Now, I believe when it comes to the Middle East, Anthony is one of the most balanced and educated voices that are out there. His book, when he was doing research for the Blogging Revolution, he went to he went basically, it was the use of the blogosphere in totalitarian regimes. So he went and did research in Cuba, Afghanistan, Iran, Palestine. You know, he went everywhere. And he is a young Australian Jew. And for folks that might be familiar with him, the Zionist establishment absolutely hates him. They spend a lot of money every year trying to destroy him. And he's been trying to get on Rachel Maddow's program, because I think Rachel has been doing some of the best reporting on what's been going on in Iran, hands down.
She has.
You know, and Anthony, who is unbelievably skeptical about the mainstream media when it comes to anything in the Middle East, even said to me in a chat yesterday that, hey, you know, he said, I even have to say she's been doing a really, really fine job. He's been trying to get on her program. Now, I would like everyone out there to drop Rachel an email and say, you need to have the author of The Blogging Revolution, Anthony Lowenstein, on your show. I think he would be a great addition to having Aslan on and all these other really, really good people that she's had on to talk about this, because he's, like I said, the book is all about the use of technology, and he wrote this last year. So here in Australia, he's just doing tons and tons of media about it, and I do think that he's a really, really crucial voice in this area. And purely because of the fact that he went and toured the world to research exactly what is happening in Iran, the use of the internet for activism and changing governments, so please, I would like to see her email box flooded. I mean, he's been emailing her but gets no response, but we know that she gets hammered with stuff. I would like people to get on their emails and just say, Anthony Lowenstein, you must have this guy on. Because he's brilliant, and he's a great balanced voice, and I really think he'd be worthwhile to have in this conversation.
That's so easy enough for people to do.
Yeah. I was just talking to Anthony about it last night. And if you've not read it, I really recommend My Israel Question. It's an amazing little book. It sold gangbusters down here. It's his publisher is an outfit called Melbourne University Press, and they are wonderful publishers. They don't back down on things. They back up their authors, and they take on a lot of difficult subjects, and like I said, they're kind of not afraid, unlike a lot of publishers out there. But I do recommend both books. The Blogging Revolution, I mean, it came out last year. It's all about what's going on now. It's amazing.
Breaking news, 3:15 p.m. Pacific. Jackson has been pronounced dead, according to the L.A. Times.
Okay, now we're getting into more solid sourcing. Right on. Rest in peace, Michael. That's all I got to say. You know, unfortunately troubled guy, but...
Screwed up guy, but a brilliant musician.
Yeah, and I actually think that it's the industry that screwed him up so much. That's my opinion. I'll tell you a little Michael Jackson story. When I first got my audio degree, I was doing an internship at a place in I think it was East or West Orange, New Jersey, and we got invited to another studio down in Jersey to go and do some tracking for somebody. And I walk into the studio, and it's one of these studios that's done like big stuff, and you're kind of looking around at all the platinum albums on the wall. And I see a shot of Michael Jackson having been in the studio. And I said, you know, I said, wow, man. I said, you've really done some stuff here. He said, yeah. He said, I got to tell you about the day that that picture with Michael was taken. I said, yeah. He said, I suddenly had an understanding for why he is the way he is. And this is going back 20 years. This studio is like on a back street. I can't remember where it was in Jersey, but it was, you know, a little back street, and it was Sunday. Most of the shops are closed. And there was a little fruit shop across the street, and the guys who ran the studio got this big bowl of fresh fruit, stuff that was in season, and they had this big bowl of grapes. And Michael was just going nuts on these grapes, like basically, you know, obliterated this entire, like, you know, 4-pound bowl. And wanted to get some more. And, you know, someone from the studio said, oh, we'll send somebody out. He says, no, I can go get it. You know, it's like a Sunday in this little Jersey town. There's nobody on the street. He goes across the way to go to this little fruit stand. And by the time he paid for the bloody grapes and tried to cross the way, the entire street was flooded with probably about 2,000 people. I mean, this was like in 5 minutes. And people from the studio had to go out there and physically drag him back into the studio to basically save him from being just completely mauled. And he said,
that's,
you know, he said it was just one of the scariest things he's ever seen. You know, he said, how is it that you can possibly have any form of a normal life when you can't even go and buy yourself some bloody grapes when you're supposed to be, you know, adding some backing vocals? I think they were working on one of the Jackson Brothers solo records or something.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just, you know, the guy who ran the studio was just like, you know, he said, I've never felt so sorry for an entertainer in my life. It was just really, really, really tragic. And I think when you end up forcing people into isolation, it messes with their head. And, you know, he had been kind of in a bubble since he was a kid.
Yeah.
There are stories about the family as well being a bit, a bit control freakish and all of that. You know, it's a really, really sad thing because he was a very, very talented man. And one of my other favorite lines though is, I was very happy when Eddie Van Halen made that cameo appearance on Beat It. And when Eddie was interviewed, they said, you know, what made you want to go and do that? And he said, oh, I've always wanted to work with, oh, bloody hell, what was this producer's name for all those years? Way to blow a story, John. Never mind. It's 8 a.m. here. I things fall out of my head. Quincy Jones. He's like, I always wanted to work with Quincy Jones. Never mentioned Michael at all in the whole thing. He said, I always wanted to work with Quincy Jones. It's sad. It is sad. And if he took his own life, I can only kind of see that as being...
Well, the only thing that any of these stories are mentioning is a cardiac arrest. Of course, let's face it, in the end, all death is a cardiac arrest.
Well, yeah.
But
early reports said that he had taken sleeping pills.
You know, so it's just, I have absolutely no idea what caused it. That's, you know, that's come out and whatever. The main thing I wanted to mention was those two videos and the amount of support. That is coming out from the world population, not the governments, because I think that's doing more harm than good.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I actually think the way Obama's
from the people on the street.
Yeah, I think it was Ruth Vassalon on Maddow last night said something to similar effect that if the people make, you know, if individual students, citizens, you know, make the calls for there to be a change and make the calls of support for these protesters, it's much more effective than having governments make these comments. I have to say, no matter how much I'm pissed off with Obama about a lot of domestic issues, I think he has handled this about as well as you can. No matter, you know, the Republicans all want him to speak for the American audience. All that crap is all about trying to make political points here. And that's a horrible way to go about it. I mean, you know, and Madeleine Albright, I read a thing where she was being interviewed saying, you know, look, you know, how many times did we as a government, you know, with our words back an uprising, but then didn't actually back them up with any substance. And we're in a situation where we can't back them up with any substance, and it would be wrong to back them up with any substance, like military. You know, you look what happened in the Persian Gulf War, you know.
Yeah.
You know, stand up, we'll back you up, and then we leave them hanging and they get slaughtered, you know. And we've done this time and time again. So, you know, hey, maybe we're finally seeing some of that change we did vote for. Finally.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway, I shall let you get on to other callers.
No worries.
And, it was nice hearing from you again.
All right. Great to talk to you, Susan. You take care.
You too.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Susan out of the great Northwest. And, it's kind of like all over the place. Okay, David from Maine's just popped in the chat room. We'll be probably hearing from him at some point to be talking about this Michael Jackson thing. you know, but I do think that for the first time in a long time, I think American foreign policy has actually done the right thing. You know, by just saying, we're watching. We don't like seeing the violence. That's not right. People should be allowed to protest. And, you know, we're watching. And that's, I think, the way to handle it. But, you know, could you imagine if John McCain what had been elected? You know, that whole bomb, 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 Iran thing would be put into action, I reckon. And then where would we be? Then we would have a nuclear conflict. Then we would have a complete and utter disaster. Okay, we're getting more confirmations now. It does appear that Michael Jackson has passed. Condolences to the family. All of that, I think it's sad. It's a sad day, but he was a troubled guy. And, well, I mean, we don't know, we haven't had it confirmed whether it was the sleeping pills or not. But anyway, rest in peace, Michael. Now, Betsy's asking me to talk more about Farrah Fawcett. And here we go, pop culture hour. But hey, you know, that infamous poster of her sold 12 million copies in the day. I mean, that's big numbers. But, you know, I thought it was very touching the way that Ryan O'Neal handled himself during this, you know, and, you know, finally kind of beat her over the head long enough with proposals that she accepted. And when I first heard about her, you know, that broadcasted video diary of hers, I kind of thought, oh, that's kind of morbid and whatnot. But then I read later that there were reports that the cancer foundations, some of them, you know, did a year's worth of fundraising in 2 weeks. So if that was the end result of kind of exposing this horrible, horrible thing that she was going through, you know, good on her. I mean, I just can't imagine. I mean, I remember back in the day, you know, probably 3 out of 5 of my friends had that infamous pinup in their bedrooms. I mean, she was the pinup girl of that era. But she really did kind of, shed that whole image later in life. She had she did that, was it Burning Beds or something, film a few years back? Yeah, The Burning Bed. And it was that really, really was a very powerful film. And it really did give women the power to escape domestic violence, as Texas Betsy said. And, you know, for all the beat up that Hollywood gets over a lot of things, film and media can do good. It can do good. It can have a positive effect. And, you know, there's one. I do think it's sad. And I think it's really sad about her son being in prison over the drug charges. I would almost imagine that. I mean, I don't remember any of the details of it. I really couldn't care less as far as whatever he did. But, you know, his mom was in pretty bad shape. You know, I could see someone turning to a few drugs to kill the pain, too. You know, what? But at least the corrections department did allow him to go and see her before she passed away. So, you know, good on them. The corrections department aren't the ones that that convicted him over a drug offense. But you know, it's sad stuff. You know, I can't say that I'm nearly as sad about Ed McMahon, but that's just because I just thought he turned into a massive huckster in his later life, you know, just shilling stuff. But anyway, but he was a great one too. You know, I mean, he's a legend of entertainment, and you know, his days with Johnny Carson were genius. I mean, I did grow up during the Carson era, and you know, hey. And having just lost a family member myself not all that long ago, I understand where the families are at this moment. It's a really, really sad and tragic thing. So I'll tell you what we're going to do, folks. We're going to have a little bit of a break. I need a cup of coffee because it's still early in the morning here in Australia. And let's see. Oh, hey, some Nick Cave. Let's play something Australian. We'll just go with this one. The title track off of Dig Lazarus Dig. A bit of Nick Cave. You're listening to the Head On Radio Network. This is Head On with Bob Kincaid. And it would be nice if it would play. There we go. There you go. Nick Cave. You listen to The Horn, America's liberal voice. We'll be back.
The Larry made his nest up in the autumn branches, built from nothing but high hopes and thin air. Collected up some baby blasted mothers. They took their chances, and for a while they lived quite happily up there. He came from New York City, man, but he couldn't take the pace. And thought it was like a dog-eat-dog world. And he went to San Francisco, spent a year in outer space with a sweet little San Franciscan girl. San Franciscan girl. I can hear my mother wailing and a whole lot of scraping of shells. I don't know what it is, but there's got me something going on upstairs. He had to get out of there, and San Francisco, well, I don't know. And then to L.A., where he spent about a day. He thought even the pale sky stars were smart enough to keep well away from L.A. Meanwhile, Larry made up names for the ladies, like Miss Boo and Miss Quick. He stockpiled weapons and took pot shots in the air. He feasted
sit on their lovely bodies like a lunatic and rest and sup up in their soft yellow hair. I can hear chants and incantations, and some guy is mentioning me in his prayers. Well, I don't know what it is, but there's definitely something going on upstairs. LA, I don't know, but Larry grew increasingly neurotic and obscene. I mean, he never asked to be raised up from a tomb. I mean, no one ever actually asked him to forsake his dreams. Anyway, to cut a long story short, fame finally found him. Mirrors became his torturers. Cameras snapped him at every chance. The women all went back to their homes and their husbands with secret smiles on the corners of their mouths. He ended up, like so many of them do, back in the streets of New York City, in a soup queue, a dope fiend, a slave, then prison, then the madhouse, then the grave. Oh, poor Larry. But what do we really know of the dead, and who actually cares? Well, I don't know what it is, but there's definitely something going on upstairs.
That's some of the Nick Cave stuff that I really like. Yes, 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 and we are going to get to some Michael Jackson stuff. I've had to get it from outside of the studio. I'm getting it all down now because, well, like, I do have most of the discography, but it's on my dead PC, so I'm having to get it from other places. Thank you, ELO, and we're getting there. So, I'm gonna get in touch with David from Maine here in just a few minutes. But I figure that now that I've actually got one ready, we should play one. And we'll start with this one just because, hey, I'm a massive Van Halen nut. I love the fact that Eddie went and did this track. And if memory serves me right, when Eddie showed up to do the solo of this, they had, I think, the chorus lined up for him to solo over. And he listened to the track once. He says, I don't want to solo over that. I want to solo over this other section. And they said, no, but this is where we want you to solo. He goes, well, I'm not going to solo there. I want to solo there. And it was early computer editing at the time, and so they kind of took a break, and they went and chopped it back up and re-chopped, I think it's the bridge section, and one take, one of the most famous guitar solos in pop music history. Beat it. Rest in peace, Michael. It's coming. Media player's slow today. Wait, Jennifer Batten is one hell of a guitar player, the girl playing the rhythm on this.
Just beat it. You better run, you better do what you can. Don't wanna see no blood, don't be a macho man.
I had to start there. We're gonna do another one here, just because really we gotta do this. You know, we really gotta do this. Probably my favorite Michael Jackson solo album ever was Off the Wall. I mean, just an amazing R&B pop record, incredible. And you know, just this was a Quincy Jones masterpiece, and I think one of the best tracks off the album. I mean, this is just like, you know, kind of pop disco R&B heaven. Rock with you. Rest in peace, Michael. Come on, media player. Now that's some session playing for you. I mean, listen to that band. I mean, you just cannot deny how unbelievable the musicianship was, you know, and hey, Quincy Jones, baby. I mean, you know, there's been little that the man has ever touched that didn't turn into absolute gold. Just an absolute, absolute, genius when it comes to production. We're gonna go and do the top of the hour break thingy. And when we come back, I'm gonna get David from Maine on the line. Being our pop culture correspondent, I reckon he'll have a fair bit to talk about when it comes to Michael Jackson. He'll probably remember a whole lot of things that I can't remember. So I have to say, I did kind of lose track of him over the last few years just because the circus that was around him, it ended up being so little about the music and much more about the circus. And, you know, that's just, you know, unbelievably tragic. So what I'm attempting to do here at the moment is just get one more track. Now, get this. This is what I'm having. ELO sent me a bunch of tracks, which is just absolutely brilliant. But I have to download them to one machine and then Bluetooth them to the other machine so I can play it. Don't ask me why, but this is what I've been forced to do this morning. And you'll probably hear a little... Yeah, see, that's going, "Hi, Bluetooth!" And that one's just about... We're getting one more here coming across. And so we'll get David on. We'll talk about this a bit. You know, he might even have something to say about Farrah Fawcett, too. I mean, geez, we're turning Bob's head on into the pop culture kind of music and, you know, silly show. But, hey, these are icons of entertainment. And, you know, they left a mark. And for sure, you know, Michael Jackson left a mark. Farrah Fawcett, you know, had a couple of runs in the spotlight. One kind of cheesy, and then later, you know, hey, and this is what happens when people kind of grow up. You know, they start to do more meaningful things. So we're going to close out this hour with one that ELO says that she just absolutely loves. And I think that this is a great song, too. Black or White. You're listening to John Fox running head-on, having hijacked the thing for a couple of days. This is America's Liberal Voice. We'll see you after the break.
Don't make- We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid. It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
All right, everybody. Sorry about the false start there. Media players just being a real pain in the butt today. But welcome back to Head On here as we get into Hour 2, and we're paying homage to the lost a bit today. Kind of serious in a different way, but what we have right now is our good friend David on the line. Hey, David, how you going, mate?
How you doing, John?
Oh, I'm doing all right. It's been a busy news morning over on this side of the world in ways that I wasn't quite expecting.
Yeah, I can imagine that. You know, the first thing when it crossed the news line, I knew Michael was going to commit suicide because, you know, he hinted it in his songs previously, like one of his songs, Morphine. And it kind of like precedes with what happened today. I think we talked. We talked a little bit about the song Morphine, and we talked a little bit about Michael Jackson and his Machiavellian nature when it came to business.
Yeah.
And one of the things, for those that didn't hear, who are listening now, and including the Mike Malloy listeners, I know you're probably like, oh, God, I've heard enough of this for the day. But I'll try to make it an interesting Michael story instead of talk about the moonwalk. You know, Michael was obsessed with being number one. And when I say obsessed, he was obsessed to a level that you or I can't fathom.
Right.
And what I mean by that is the president of CBS, Walter Yetnikoff, had to deal with Michael. And one of the dealings that he had to do was take calls at every hour of the day when Bad came out. And Michael would call up periodically and say, am I number one? Am I number one still? Michael, Billboard still hasn't come out yet, but I'm going to tell you, I'm going to promise you, you're number one, because I got to be number one. I'm number one, Aaron. It was beyond anything anyone could ever imagine, and I remember reading that, and I was like, wow. Now here's a megalomaniac himself, an admitted megalomaniac, and he's saying Michael was in a different universe. Forget a dimension. He was in a different universe of megalomania.
On that point, you know, that whole King of Pop thing was a demand by, I think, the label to MTV that if they wanted to get the content, they had to refer to him as the King of Pop every time they mentioned his name. And, you know, it tied into that, you know, greatest rock band on the planet thing of the Stones, and then Howard Stern played his game saying, see, look, you say something enough times, it becomes the truth. So that's when he did the King of All Media thing, saying, I'm going to do this as a gag, and sure enough, in like 6 months, people were calling him in print the King of All Media.
But you know why he did the King of Pop? That, by the way, that was Michael all the way, just so you know that. I mean, he was Machiavellian about... he mapped everything out. The reason why he called himself King of Pop, for those who don't know, is the fact that Prince was popular at that time, and it was he saw him as competition. Purple Rain had come out, you know, there was, I think at that time it was Sign of the Times, and he saw that Prince was putting out an album out every year, and it freaked him out, even to the point where he named his kid, he named one of his surrogate kids Prince.
I mean, really? I had forgotten that. You know, I really do think, you know, I don't want to rake him over the coals too much. I mean, he did just pass away, and his music is important in the history of in the history of the industry. You know, but he was a complicated individual, and you know, he hadn't made a dime for a record label in almost 20 years, I think.
Here's a little fun fact for you. The original Bad, everybody remembers Michael Jackson's Bad, right?
Yeah.
I actually played drums in junior high at school in that. But anyway, I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe we're playing this song. People think we're trying to be hip, too hip on this one.
Oh, I remember school band directors trying to
do
that stuff.
Yeah, I know. It was sad. We would take these awful songs and Not that Michael Jackson Bad is an awful song, but they played it 19,000 times a day. It wasn't cool when you were playing it.
Yeah.
But anyways, you know, the original Bad, for those that don't know, is I'm going to tie it back to the Prince thing, because people don't realize how much of a fixation that the whole King of Pop, Bad, everything came at that time. So Michael Jackson originally wanted Bad to be a duet with Prince, because the video concept was, in the song, Your Blood Is Mine.
Oh!
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I totally see it now. It was,
and
right.
And here's a funny story. Michael and Prince had a meeting, and I can't make this up.
Well, the ego flooding that room must have been insane.
They had respect for each other, but the only thing they could think of to do a competitive match, because Michael wanted to see if he could beat Prince at anything, because let's face it, folks, Prince is a musician and a songwriter, and across the catalog, it was no competition. Now, when Michael was with Quincy and all those other people, yes, but Prince by himself. But anyways, Michael and Prince, to settle their differences, they played ping pong. And Prince was nailing, according to accounts, Prince was really into it, because he was just so upset that Michael would think of that he planned this whole video out, and he said, okay, we're going to fight it out, and of course I'm going to win. Like, Michael had the audacity to say to Prince, all right, we're going to do a duet, and you're going to be the loser.
See?
You know? And for those people who think I'm joking or I'm making this up, go look it up, people. It's true. Bad was originally supposed to be a duet with Prince. That's why in the first line of the song, it says, your butt is mine, because he was talking about Prince.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
That's the kind of person Michael was. But, you know, on the other side of things, he had these great socio-political type anthems.
Oh, yeah.
Like Man in the Mirror. That's
gonna be
a standard.
Yeah, that's a great song.
I mean, and the video that he made, whoever directed that video and edited it together was masterful. I mean, you got to think, that was back in 87?
When Speaking Out was considered a really, really, you know, like, you know, I remember back at that time, if you didn't just kind of go with what was being done and didn't just
right.
go, yes, and, you know, we're all conservatives now and all that kind of stuff. It was actually a really huge step. I don't know if you caught the story that I told about the New Jersey recording studio.
Oh yes, I did.
Right, you know, and to me that speaks volumes to, you know, regardless of the ego and all of that that was going on and the Machiavellian vibe.
Yeah.
You know, how much is it's like chicken and the egg, you know, in a way. Which came first?
You know what Walter Yednikoff said, again, for those people who just tuned in, the president of CBS, he said that Michael would sit in his war room, so to speak, and plan and plot all of these. Now, if I do the hyperbaric chamber thing, that's really going to get him. You think I should get the hyperbaric chamber? That's what he did.
Yeah.
That's what made him a genius of media and sensationalism. People think that the... Listen, people, if you think that Michael didn't have a plan of putting out all this stuff, the Elephant Man, why do you think the Inquirer got so many stories? Because his whole publicist and his whole entourage was feeding him lines after lines after lines. And then they said, oh, my God. And that's what propelled the album even more. Because they said, oh, you're picking on Michael. That's a... Oh, you damn it. I can't believe you would do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that lasted... You know, for example, remember when Michael went to the Grammys with Webster?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
Yes. Yes. See? That's what I mean. Michael understood how to work the media like no one on earth.
Oh, yeah.
And this was before the internet.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, he was a genius as far as that. And I do think that, you know, you started to see the signs of him actually kind of losing touch with it all when he dumped Quincy. Quincy made him.
You know, the funny thing about how Michael Jackson works with or collaborates with other musicians was the fact that it was always had to be. Remember, people, Reagan was like one of his number one idols, and there's a reason for it behind it, because he was extremely charming, extremely political, and that's what Michael was in the industry. He was a very political figure. Everyone he worked with. I mean, don't kid yourself. Eddie Van Halen, when he worked with Eddie Van Halen, Michael probably knew only Jump. That was it. And he heard the solo, and he said, he's hot. I think there's also a part in that book that talks about this. What's the name of that guitarist? Okay, put him on there. The guitar solo? Yeah, that'll be good.
Yeah, and Eddie, when asked about it, he said, yeah, I always wanted to work with Quincy Jones.
Yeah, and just a slight correction for you. Jennifer Batten was on... Dirty Diana, it was Steve Lukather and Paul Jackson on Beat It.
Oh, right. Oh, that's right.
Yeah,
Lukather,
yeah.
That's right. That's right.
And
pardon
that's the
me.
Other thing. That's the other thing. Lukather was going to do the solo, too, and he was going to work the whole guitar track. But then he realized what it was like in that camp. They were always planning and plotting in that Machiavellian style, like, who can we get on this track to kick ass?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he understood that it was like on a whole different level because they were already planning to make Thriller into this supernova. But the funny thing about that was nobody could have predicted the impact and the influence of that album in the same respect that when Purple Rain came out.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, I mean, again, you know, you talk about the calculation. That was
right.
A stroke of genius to get Eddie on that song because, you know, when I was a massive Eddie Van Halen fan, you know, a Van Halen fan in general, and, you know, was a metalhead back in the day, and, like, you would never admit to owning a Michael Jackson record in the day, but once Eddie played on that track, it was fine to go and buy that Michael Jackson album.
There are stories of Michael being able to, like, flip on and an off switch of, like, that weirdness. And maybe eventually what happened is he couldn't flip it on and off. Like, for example, remember when Paul McCartney and Michael were friends and they did the Say, Say, Say video?
Oh, that was a tragic...
Yeah, yeah. And that was an example of Paul McCartney really, really trying to cross over. Come on, people, I'm your friend. You know? And here's the funny thing about it. During the video shoot, this is the kind of vindictive person that Michael is, people. And people still love him. Then they don't want to hear stories like this, but it's still funny because this is the kind of person Michael was. Paul McCartney was going on and on about his masters and publishing and goes, you know, they're going to have an auction pretty soon. And he goes, I'd like to get those Beatles masters. And Michael's like, wait a minute. He goes, you mean to tell me the whole Beatles catalog is going to go up for sale?
Oh, man.
And Paul McCartney's like, yeah. He goes, I'm going to do that. And he thought Michael was kidding, and he said, well, I'm going to beat you to it.
And he did.
But he wasn't kidding.
No, he wasn't kidding at all. And it was his ownership of that catalog that actually kept him in the black at all for years, because his albums never covered costs.
Can I tell you the biggest tragedy? Some people are going to hate me for saying this, but the biggest tragedy is going to be the media spectacle on this, the estate trial.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to take so many news stories. So many, John. CNN, Fox, everyone, is, forget all your stories. They're all dead. As soon as this estate trial hits the pages, and I bet you Michael didn't have a will. I bet you he didn't. It's so tragic.
Oh, you'd hope that, hope at least his handlers would have done something with it. But I mean, he was selling off everything he could recently, because he really was in some financial trouble. I think this feeds into my view of what the music industry has turned into. We no longer do art for art's sake, and it's units, and it's all of this, and there's just way too much money involved. Just, here's a guy that was consistently a really good artist as far as, putting out, consistent material. But
yeah.
The machine gets to be so massive around him that you can't even make up costs when you have an album that sells 10 million copies.
I think another thing a lot of people seem to forget is the fact that Michael was in the same space. What happened when he released Off the Wall and more respectively Thriller is in the same type of parallel to what happened when Steven Spielberg released Jaws. What I mean to say, people, is that changed the paradigm in how we promote media and how we sell media in a way we can't possibly fathom, because that time is gone. And I know you understand what I'm saying, John. But that is why so many people fall through the cracks, in the sense that they can't sell those numbers, they can't get those screenings. It doesn't have that same shining intensity of light.
Yeah.
People consider it a failure because of the corporation machine behind it telling people, say that's a failure, because they wanted to wipe off competition off the map, which is one of the reasons. Why, when you turn on the radio, for example, when I was reading Hitman, which is a really popular music industry book, one of the things they say in it is people really were daft and naive of how the business worked. Michael Jackson didn't just get 40 rotations because people were requesting it, and Pink Floyd didn't get that when they released Off the Wall like that.
Oh,
they had serious payola mafia. They were called Hitmen.
Oh, yeah.
Who would go to the DJs, and they would literally say, I would expect for you to play this record a little bit more time, a little bit more. I mean, they would threaten with violence. New York City, L.A., Chicago, those target areas. And people think it's like, no, that didn't happen. No, that's what they would do, because that's how much demand was on them. And they were like, it's sad that your family, you're so long away from your family. It'd be a shame if you were away from them a little bit longer. They would do things like that.
A couple of years ago, there was the big expose about the six Sony executives that, flew around the world basically doing the payola game. And I'm sitting there going, I've met two of them. we've always known about this. This is always what's gone on.
Let me tie this into the downfall of society, what we faced. I can do that with Michael Jackson and Spielberg and all of that. Michael Bay recently came out and said, I'm not interested in doing big-budget movies anymore. Excuse me? You're the one who created the format. You created the blueprint, and this is what we all deal with. We have to deal with what Transformers, Armageddon, all of these films that Michael Bay was making and producing, the Pearl Harbor spectacle, all of those, it's the same thing with Jaws. It's the same type of catalyst. When you have something that popular and that massive, people don't understand the fractures it puts in the art form and the media behind them, because they don't see that. The curtain isn't revealed. And we're starting to see it.
Holy shit, man. I'm sorry to interrupt you. This day might just be fucking cursed, man.
The Jeff Goldblum thing?
Yeah.
You know, speaking of Jeff Goldblum, I always respected him as an actor. We might as well just stay on the phone naming off names. I'm not going to name any, obviously, but I don't care what anyone said. I like the remake of The Fly. I always loved him when he did appearances.
I thought he was good in that. I've always been kind of hot and cold on him. Now, we're not... ELO is saying that she hasn't found any confirmation on it, and I'm looking for it as well. But I did find a link that suddenly wasn't going anywhere, and it's coming out of the New Zealand media. Wow, this is just a really bizarre day. If this is true,
to me, Jeff Goldblum was always really, really he was talented, man. When he would go on the late night show, I don't know if you saw any of his appearances, but he was a really talented pianist, and he could really play.
Well, he's been on Colbert recently.
Yeah.
Now, do me a favor, man. If you've got the web there, I keep searching and I find this link for moviesonline.ca, but the page won't come up for me and the site won't come up for me at all.
So moviesonline.ca.
Yeah. See if you get this, because it's the top result when you go to news on Google, and it's the only link that I'm finding about this report of him having died on the set of his new movie.
I am getting blanked.
That's
out. I wonder if the white page.
I wonder if they've just gotten hammered, and the server's choked.
Or it could just be one of those spam sites that just puts a bunch of keywords together.
Betsy's just put the same link into the chat room, so it's telling me that maybe she's gotten it actually to come up. So
you know, I saw this. I saw the announcement of Jeff Goldblum on Twitter, but I'm always skeptical, especially with the. I don't know if you heard about the Eddie. I don't know who started it, but that thing went rampant. The Eddie Murphy, when he died, that hoax.
I missed that one.
He passed away. That was like a few months ago, and people were just going crazy, saying, no, not Eddie Murphy. I mean, it went over all the net everywhere. And, you know, that's a danger. People think that this is funny, or they get attention from it, and they get this kind of adrenaline rush. But, God, man, I would hate to be a family member for that to happen to me.
I just feel really, really weird at the moment that, like, you know, my guest hosting of Bob's show has turned all into this pop culture, you know, stuff. But, I mean...
But, you know, it says something. It really says something about where we're at. When I try to tell people about issues, people, take a look at Twitter. This is why I keep telling people, you're going to have to expect, as Chris Rock says, the pain is going to be brought. Bring the pain is definitely in season, because people are not paying attention to the stories that are of importance to them at this moment.
Yeah.
They care about the spectacle. They care about the flashing lights. And it's a narcissistic vibe that's surrounding us, and it keeps getting louder and louder and louder. And people don't understand how destructive that is, because so many people... You could do so much good in the world if you took a focus off this. I mean, that's why I don't promote TMZ. I know a lot of people like looking at and going to TMZ and all of that. But you know what? That culture is so toxic when you have everything happening in the world at this point. I like stories when it comes to pop culture of relevance, and you learn something from it that you can learn from in your daily life and the world around you. When it's just like, oh, my God, Chris Rock really pimp-slapped Rihanna. And that's all there is.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't do anything with it.
Yeah, well, but, you know, the whole Twitter thing, I have such a mixed vibe on, you know.
You know, my favorite Twitter, people, you got to search him. My favorite Twitter is this crazy guy who literally tweets, sorry, I got the wrong ad. He tweets. I'm not making this up, John. He tweets books. He's like, I'm not letting this Twitter thing destroy me. Chapter one.
You're kidding.
All right, people. No, he does. He tweets books, people.
That's insane.
And when I mean he tweets books, for those people who don't know, Twitter, they only have 140 characters. So you figure out. You figure out how long it takes him to do a chapter. But he has these long – this is what I like about a lot of crazy people in this world. You know, a lot of people say, well, that's awful. That's a shame. That's a tragedy. And he's like, no, he's being put to use, and this is what he wants to do. And if people are motivated to read a book, then you know what I say? Don't give this guy any medication. Let him continue.
I reckon it's got to be the longest form way to get your book out. And you'd have to read it all backwards. You'd have to go to the first twit, and then scroll up. How confusing!
Well, the problem that we face is not just this idiocracy thing that we're going through, but it's also this anti. I don't know how to put it in another terms, but it really is this intimidation that a lot of people feel of getting a little bit more intelligent and at the same time growing and learning. They want to stay in that safe place, and I can understand why people want to stay in reality TV. I can completely relate to that, because the fact is this is how they are. It's the conditioning is so tightened and so strong in America right now, and probably in. You know what? It's probably in Australia. It's probably other places. But here in America, the conditioning is so tightened that, you know, when you see these images, you look on Twitter and you see the top 10 categories, and it's not a coincidence that there's Real Housewives, John and Kate.
And any time a new internet vehicle comes up, like Twitter, like Facebook, like MySpace.
Right.
You know, it starts out as being something for people to be involved with, and then governments, corporations have to jump on it. They end up swamping, you know, these systems with their commercial stuff, their propaganda stuff, and it ends up actually overshadowing, you know, the people that are actually trying to put, you know, actual real content out there, you know, serious or not. You know,
right.
I'm finding now that as time goes on, the more, you know, the ratio of, you know, like listeners and things, you know, being new Twitter friends and bloody corporate spamming via Twitter is just changing dramatically, to where I'm now getting to the point where, you know, it used to be 1 out of 10. Now it's probably 7 out of 10.
Look what Huffington Post does. A lot of people don't pay attention to
this. They're pissing me off. They're pissing me off.
What is that?
Big time.
No. This will piss you off even more, or it'll make you go, aha. I was reading a post, and I was wondering, why the hell were they promoting Bruno so much? This anonymous person jumps up and says, wow, you guys are still taking ad revenue from Universal to keep plugging and hammering Bruno into our consciousness. Like, that's kind of shameful. Because don't you have enough money already? And I was like, whoa. And I mean, that's really what's going on. That's what's happened to Huffington Post.
Yeah.
So many bribes are taken. It's true, John. I mean, we can't stop ignoring it. I mean, it's obvious to me with what they did with Bruno. Brilliant entertainer.
And now they have that little spot in the right sidebar that has very subtly advertisements, but then you'll see like, watch the new clean diesel Audi, blah blah blah, and it's not like a Google ad or something that comes up via a random server. It's something that they have actually put a video up with a little disclaimer, an advertisement. And
I wouldn't be surprised, John, if we went to an advertising room and a publicity room, that on the board, like on some. Glengarry Ross stuff, you know, the Al Pacino, and I don't know if you know that movie, the Kevin Spacey and all that.
Which one?
Anyway, what's that?
Which film?
The Glengarry Ross about real estate, Al Pacino, and
I don't think I've seen that one.
All right, well, you got to see it. It's a staple of our Western culture and what we're at today. Anyways, I would bet you that on one of those boards is no longer it says play to win, it says play to cheat. Because,
yeah.
I mean, that's really what, I mean, I hate to say it, but that's really what artists have to deal with now. A lot of people don't understand. It's like, yeah, you want to go with this company. You want to go with this company that if you don't play by their rules, they're going to bury you now. And they can bury you.
Yeah, I remember even, you know, I in the early days of MTV, and I don't know if they still do this, but they used to have an afternoon, you know, ring-in thing for, you know, voters, you know, viewers' choice of the day kind of thing.
Right.
And I'm trying to remember the name of the band, and I can't think of the name of the band at the moment.
Oh, speaking of funny, we didn't talk about it, but that Bret Michaels video, when he gets hit in the head with the...
Hey, man, I'm sorry. The stage manager that was, the technical stage manager of that production shouldn't work for the next 5 years. My view of that, I don't care if he wasn't on his mark or not. A technical production stage manager's job not only is to make call cues, but is also to make sure that people don't get hit by flying fucking set pieces. And I, you know, and they're going, oh, he didn't hit his mark. I've worked so many theater productions where, for whatever reason, someone wasn't in the spot that they needed to be, and the technical stage manager gets on the cans and say, hold the flies, hold the flies. And that, and this is also what, this has been one of my fears of actually the automating of theater sets, right? You know, in the day, it used to be guys on ropes that actually had a line of sight, and you used a black and white camera with an infrared light so that you can actually see the stage in the dark, and that way you could see and make adjustments in timing, but that production stage manager should be blackballed and never work for the next 5 years for actually letting that happen. I don't care how off his mark he was. I don't give a shit.
Oh, I agree with you. I think with an incident like that, I think the reason why it went viral in the way it did, Bret Michaels was not known to be nice to a lot of people. I think whoever had the whoever put that up first, the footage, that was a sort of like vendetta or vengeance against him or whatever.
Regardless of who first put the footage out,
yeah,
it was the response from the people who put the production on that sent me through the roof. Because I mean, this is what I used to do, right?
Right.
I used to do this stuff, and I used to watch, you know, the. In the days before an opening night of a technical theater production, watching technical stage managers, the calling stage managers, just sweating it and sitting there going through their cue sheets over and over in their head, telling people to just leave them alone for hours as they map through everything to make sure that, regardless of anything else, if there's a mistake during a performance, that's the least important thing when you're moving big pieces of set or having stage lifts go. People's lives are in your hands. People don't actually understand that when you're doing technical musical theater and things like that, it's actually a very dangerous place. I was working on a production of the Rocky Horror Show here. It was one of the first things that I did. Multi-million dollar production here. It was brilliant. And the show opened with the castle downstairs, and it came up the big stage lifts and then track forward, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of the show, the assistant stage manager, who was the son of the producers, kind of forgot where he was and stepped backwards through a black straight into the open pit. Landed almost on the guy who was playing Riff Raff's lap with his head split open.
Wow.
Okay. And this was not actually due to anybody's fault. Everything was actually done right. But the law got changed after that happened that a black velvet curtain in front of an open pit needed to be 4 meters in front and not just one, because basically he stepped backwards through it once and hit nothing. And everyone reckons he knew what happened when he went down. And I watched the cast. I've never seen the stage manager, who actually was not at fault in any way in this. This was just a tragic accident. I have a feeling she's still never recovered from that.
Wow. You know, to me it just seems like with everything happening, when you were talking about the situation with Iran, I mean, it's become such a spectacle that I said this on Twitter. I said, if you want this spectacle to continue, you're going to have more martyrs, and you're going to have more blood, and people are going to have more cameras on the street. Because that's what the media is going to want. Because they've already seen. I mean, I was reading the Twitter off one of the news anchors, and he said, thanks for that footage, but that's old from 4 days ago. You know, even if they didn't broadcast it, this is the mindset that it doesn't matter if it's compelling footage or it has to be fresh and current, and it has to have something that the other footage didn't have. And this is what's dangerous about the media we live in now.
Yeah, and actually Obama spoke to this at his press conference the other day.
Yeah.
Where he actually, you know, I think it was Chuck Todd or somebody was saying, you know, about this, that, or the other thing. He said, you guys live by a 24-hour news cycle. I don't. And I thought that was a really, really smart thing to bring up, that these are, you know, he wasn't going to allow the 24-hour news cycle to, you know, push how he was handling it. And
you know, we live in such a privileged society in this country that I find it pretty humorous and funny that so many people are afraid to talk about Pakistan and the drone attacks lately that they've
I actually had that on my list for yesterday and didn't get to it. This is a part of that, you know, what fucking change? I find this use of drones to be cowardly.
But you see what they did, what the Democrats or what the party in power did was they did a catch 22 on us, and a lot of people didn't notice it because the fact that Obama is a new face to Washington, the fact that he's a black American, an African, and has that multiculturalism in him, it will look like any time we criticize a person like Obama and his cabinet, it'll be like, wow, you people are really, really racist. You got to give Obama a chance. But really, I don't blame Obama personally in that whole aspect. What I blame is the whole system at large. I mean, because the fact is when you have a drone attack in Pakistan, think about any other country that would have a drone attack like that, and if they had that same ratio of misses, we would still be on their ass, John. Imagine if North Korea did that. Imagine if Russia did that. That's why to me it's criminal. I mean, just to come out and say, well, there were some Al-Qaeda associates. Oh, really? Well, you know, Al-Qaeda means the base.
Yeah.
What were they really affiliated with? I don't know. We'll never know these people. And really, What was it? It was a bombing of a funeral? I just don't buy it.
Well, that whole association thing, like at the moment we have all around Australia this massive crackdown on the bikie gangs, right? And there was a little bit of a bikie war that was going on in the middle of Sydney, but they went and passed all these bikie-specific laws. And I remember them saying that, you know, they picked up people who were known associates of bikies. And I'm sitting there going,
right.
Now, where... How exactly, what do you consider an associate? Because I could easily be labeled as an associate of bikie gangs. Because, well, how many gigs have I worked on where half the crew was bikies doing that kind of work? Or, you know, a couple of bands that I've worked for in the past had possible bikie ties. And because I work for the band, am I then going to be labeled as an associate of a bikie gang when I've actually had no actual contact with the bikie gang? You know, and I look at it the same way, you know, known associate. It's just like, okay, yeah. This guy who might have been, you know, some sort of suicide bomber planner, you know, buy something from some store merchant somewhere. Is he a known associate?
Exactly. And, you know, another thing is it's the frames we play in that are so toxic, like what George Lakoff was saying, or like the negative frames that Frank Luntz creates in his own home with his dials and switches and things. Is that, you know, here's a frame that a lot of people don't pay attention to, but it really is poisonous and it really is toxic, John, counterterrorism. Because the fact when you say counterterrorism, you're implying that someone that you're attacking is a terrorist. And you can't distinguish if they're innocent, it doesn't matter because you've just thrown the word counterterrorism at them.
And it also makes it sound like you're countering terrorism with more terrorism.
That's true too. I mean and then you know this goes into what Jeremy Scahill was saying on Bill Moyers, which I really suggest you watch that interview. For those people who haven't seen that interview, it's powerful stuff. He says that what Naomi Klein was saying regarding disaster capitalism, regarding these huge embassies, these Vaticans, to keep their stronghold, they need to continue with the chaos. And with that chaos comes the horror, but don't take it for granted when you hear someone firing on some innocent people. And then that begs the question, so does the military want an attack on the U.S. soil? Is that what they're after now? And you don't know. That's the fog of war, like the McNamara documentary. You don't know, and that's how it's intended. We can theorize and we can talk all day long about how the military thinks. But you know what I think? I think there's so many mirrors and so much smoke right now. I think everyone is completely confused in every single agency because they don't communicate, they don't talk.
Oh,
this is what happens.
I totally agree. I totally agree. And this again, I have to, with the whole Iran thing, you know, we were talking about, you know, the use of Twitter and all that and how it can be manipulated
right.
And all that. It has been really astounding, first of all, to watch how much kind of a lot of the you know, Iranian establishment posing as, you know, resistance people have been flushed out. That has been, you know, rather quickly. That's been rather astounding to actually watch this completely unregulated world kind of find a way to edit itself and try and get something that is kind of tangible and understandable, even though it's impossible to corroborate anything. This is where I think out of anybody, and I think this actually is outside of just my bias because I like what she does, I think Rachel Maddow has been really, really good on this because the way she's reported it has been, you know, she's made very distinctive what can be confirmed, what can't be confirmed, and how it, you know, and talked about herself as a journalist trying to do this job, how difficult it is, and how, you know, there is so much we just don't really know, but all we can do is watch and try and confirm. And see how this thing plays out, and trying to talk to as many people that have contacts on the ground as possible. I do think that one of the things that this is doing is actually showing how useless, in many ways, the corporate mainstream media can be. Because I think, imagine if all of the journalists hadn't been, you know, booted out.
Right.
We would be getting a very different filtered version of what's going on, which would overshadow the citizen journalism, however sketchy it can be. I think the portrayal of this thing would be almost 180 degrees kind of different.
So this brings the question about corporations and the mentality of it. Is it your contention that if you, the corporations, should we just let them... Should we resist and restrain them as much as possible, or the other way, is realize the corporations are going to completely throw this world into a tailspin like we've never seen, and just let that happen, in that sense, and then we pick up the pieces. What do you say on that?
Well, I think the lazy corporate media is suddenly having to, like, actually work to try and come up with some content here. You know, they're actually, it's not just being spoon-fed. You know, one wire report gets, you know, sent out to everybody, and everybody's kind of on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wish, you know, and you know, there is good journalism and there is bad journalism. And good professional journalism on the ground would be what we would want. You know, to get clear pictures on the ground, able to actually go and corroborate things, or, you know, be able to prove other reports as false. But it creates this, it creates something that the whole machine doesn't really quite know what to do with. And I don't know what's going to happen. I really don't know what's going to happen, but I do think that this event is actually throwing journalism as it's become on its head.
Well, that's funny that you talk about journalism and media and where we're at right now, because the fact is again, this is what we're dealing with. So while this is happening, we have to gauge and see how much of the audience is with us. And then this is where I play this game, John. Okay, you have 25% who are mildly interested, right?
Yeah.
Then you have 10% who are going to immediately fall off because they're going to be exhausted. So then that leaves you with like a block of 15%. And the problem with this is I don't think we have that much strong of a resistance, a momentum against the corporate media like this, because we were only starting at the 15 to 25% who were interested. And then what we're left with is such a paltry sum that it becomes a bloodbath, symbolically speaking. That's what I think we're dealing with.
Well,
I'm sure you feel that sentiment in a lot of ways.
Well, I sit there and try and read as much as I can that's coming out from this, and I just find this being one of the most fascinating things, and I really think it's morbid to say that, but I'm watching this going, as kind of like a self-taught media student, this is absolutely fascinating.
You know, that's the question, John, but that's the question. Ultimately, there comes a time where you have to turn the camera off, right? And you have to do your reporting and journalism.
Yeah.
At what point, when you become part of that spectacle and you start mirroring off your influence into the audience, bouncing back and forth, creating this feedback loop of chaos and destruction, you need to have that intuitiveness to realize, okay, this time the camera needs to go off. This needs not to be seen here. And I think that's again what we're dealing with the issue of just instant media like that. Because, you know, the truth is, and I hate to say this, people, but it's true, there are people in the media and there are people who watched the Iranian woman who, I don't know if you know the backstory to this, was not a protester. She caught the commotion. She wanted to see what was going on. This is the story that they're feeding into the public right now.
Yeah.
And she caught that bullet in the chest. But what I'm saying is, because that video was everywhere, that demands an instant replacement within a few weeks. And this goes back into the disaster capitalism model we talk about. And it's the house of horrors within the house of horrors. Within the house of horrors.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to show you, you know, just to end on this note, I found this interesting. There's a great article, John, I have to send you, in LA Weekly, that talks about zombie culture. And one of the professors, no, you're going to love this. One of the professors says, you know, zombies go back a long time. And please forgive me if we have some really spiritual people in this audience. He said, but, you know, Christ was just like a zombie. He did raise from the dead. And he goes, and it's this feeding of what we expect death to be like, of what we expect destruction to be like, and we have to have those bleacher seats and those tickets, and somehow we have to create it, but then at the same time we have to show that sense, or show that theatrical sense of appalled nature, like, oh, I can't believe that would happen. There's blood on the streets. Somebody's head is cracked open. I didn't intend that. And you know, I think that's where we're at right now.
I'm setting up a track to play us out for this hour that I think.
Is it Cranberry Zombie?
No. Tool. Vicarious.
Oh, Tool. You know, I have to say that it is typical John Fox. When the death of Michael Jackson happened, you were like, all right, let's play some Nick Cave.
I didn't have any of the Michael Jackson stuff in handy at the time.
You see the irony in that.
Oh.
I know you do.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, and Dig Lazarus Dig. I kind of just went like, oh, I'll just play the title track from this. And then I started listening to the lyric. I'm like going, oh, wow, this really is a bit weird.
I know. For those people who don't know Nick Cave, he's like the noir of the noir. He's the noir's noir writer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He lives in a world of murder, deceit, and horrors. That's what his writing is. It's that dark.
Yep.
And in a way, he makes it sound, And then this goes back to what we were talking about when we were talking about destruction. When Jeremy Scahill was talking about disaster capitalism. How many people in this country and in this world taking out the end timers demand to see destruction, but they, since they can't feel it, and they don't, I'm talking about the audience now, John.
Yeah.
How many do you think in this country and in this world are really truly like that? Because I'm beginning to feel, and I'm beginning to think, this is exactly what we're witnessing right now.
Look
what's happening in Iran. When you go on Twitter and you check page after page, it's not like I follow it religiously or anything, but when you check page after page on Twitter, it's like this surge of energy and adrenaline when there is an atrocity that happens, like something great's going to come out of that, which is just insane to me, because that's not what's going to happen. It's just going to be another atrocity after another atrocity, and then that comes to the point of, okay, where do you turn off the magnification on that?
Yeah.
Because there, like you said, there are other atrocities everywhere else, but you're feeding those people. It's the same thing, you know, John. It's the same thing that we do with the Von Braun thing. Or when we did with Ted Bundy, we put the spotlight on these people. We put the spotlight on these killers and murderers and just horrific figures. And then we wonder why so many people idolize and admire to be at that level.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's a – I don't think – John, I don't think it's a coincidence that we had someone come out of, like, the Columbine – and we have kids who idolize and revere those people because of the notoriety and fame they got.
Well, you know, you just made me think of something. I've never read it, and I should. But Gail talks about this book, The Seth Diaries, which she says are just really fascinating. And
right.
And there's one point where he makes a statement, something to the effect of. The act of creation, whether it's music, art, literature, anything, that is being God. And
right.
I think, unfortunately, in modern society in this world, no one makes anything anymore, really, except for a very few. We just consume. So the drive to create has actually then turned to the easier thing and the simpler thing, which is the drive to destroy.
You know, it's like with the neo-Nazis and the KKK. A lot of people don't realize, but when the media put these people on the front page and made them to be feared, completely paralyzed people, it's exactly what an organization wants. And you have to wonder if there's a part in the media's conscience that aren't racist, but they realize, you know, guys, nothing is happening this quarter, and these guys are really destructive. And they're going to take care of business on a lot of ends in this country. So you know what? I think we're going to need to do some more stories and focus on some horrors and atrocities that maybe weren't true. Maybe they were true. But you know what? We just need to get it because of this quarter, which goes back to a profit by the quarter in the near future, in the present, not seeing the bigger picture, which, again, it goes back to the destruction of everything that we face right now in this country and in this world, if you think about it.
Yeah. I've been talking about a paradigm shift that needs to take place on this planet for a long time, and I'm starting to get the impression that we're getting further away from it than actually closer.
Well, you know what's going to have to happen, John? Eventually, people are going to have to analyze and say, you know, why do we put the focus on people like Von Braun when we had the school shootings? To me, I look at it this way. When you have school shootings, you're going to have copycat and repeat killers. If you make them into a quote-unquote a martyr, because let's face it, people, when you go to the theaters, it's no coincidence why people are going to see Michael Myers, Jason,
yeah,
Leatherface, all of these icons over the years, because there's a part of that of what Kevin Gilbert referred to as your shadow self. And you want to see something that dark and horrific. And you wonder what would happen if this came to life, but by then it's too late. So my point is, when you put people like Von Braun on the cover of magazines, to me it's so destructive and so toxic. I see it happening with Huffington Post. I saw it happen with Raw Story. I see it happen with all these blogs, and they say, look at this person. Look at this person. He's despicable and incredibly hateful and a racist and a scum of the earth. But there's going to be someone there reading your article or watching that news broadcast, people, and saying, you know what? Now I know what really resonates with people. Oh, I know what I can do. And that's the problem we face right now. And that's why I didn't get into that whole Von Braun spectacle. That's why I never got into that whole Columbine. All of that. Because I realized, you know, we just want to create carbon copies of that over and over and over again and pretend that we're not interested in those horrors and atrocities of morality. But we really are. The same way that we did with the serial killers. When the Night Stalker came up, what did we do, John? We played up on Richard Ramirez's addiction to Satan.
Yeah.
And how he was all, and his obsession with AC/DC, and the pentagram on his head.
Don't even get me started on the concept of that.
I know.
Go back to the Judas Priest, you know, suicide trial and all that crap that went down. I mean, you're gonna go and blame.
We gave John Wayne Gacy exactly what he wanted. We gave Charles Manson exactly what he wanted.
Attention.
We gave Obama bin Laden exactly what we wanted. We gave Ted Kaczynski.
What? Did you just say Obama bin Laden?
Osama bin Laden. See, that's how hard, that's how easy it is to do that kind of stuff. But what I'm getting at is, and I apologize for that, but that shows you the kind of slip because of this, how close the letters are together. Maybe he should have just called himself Barry O. But I mean that's the other thing. I mean. What I'm saying is what we're dealing with in this country right now is we like creating these gigantic monsters in the media. And I'm seeing on the liberal blog side, too, and whatever buildup of media, Huffington Post and all of these, we focus on these horrific people or these people who are completely deranged. We put them on the spotlight, and then we wonder, like I said, it's no secret why we kept putting serial killer after serial killer after that. I'm thank God, John, that we didn't have all of those. Can you imagine if we had Hitler in the age of YouTube? This world would be gone.
You're probably right, man. You're probably right.
I mean, that's what I'm saying, and I'm not talking about censorship, people. I'm talking about
glamorizing. Through overexposure.
I'm talking about sensationalism, and that's why we can't get caught up in this spectacle. That's why, whoever it is, that's why it wasn't for totally going crazy over talking about how crazy and insane and horrific Cheney was. I just thought, you know, here's a dysfunctional man in office, and he's been in the Washington shadows too long, and he loves this.
He's one of the most calculating guys in modern political history. I mean, come on.
Right, and here's the other frame. They say it, and this is the problem, John. They keep saying, "Oh, these guys were so incompetent. They didn't know what they were. They didn't know what to do." And it's like it's one of those moments where you just go, "No." Even Bill Maher says it, John. Even Bill Maher. Everyone says they were so incompetent. No, it's what Naomi Klein was just saying exactly.
Yeah.
To create the chaos and disaster. You can profit off it on this model, and you don't even have to worry about a plan. Because you are king, baby. You are king. Go forward.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Hey, man, I'm way over for doing the top of the hour break, and because of what you've been on, I do want to play this track Vicarious, because you probably know the lyric, but it's basically the hook cracked me up in a painful way the first time I heard it. I need to watch things die from a good, safe distance. And I think that this...
All right, man. I look forward to talking to you again. And people, call up and ring in the remaining hours that John is on. And tune in Sunday for the resurrection, pun intended, of John Fox.
Thanks.
He's not a zombie, people.
Thanks a lot.
For you.
Thanks a lot, David. Always great to talk to you, man. You have a great day,
man.
All
right, later.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye. All right, we're going to go and take this break really late. And if you're on the web and you're not familiar with Tool... look up the lyric to this song. Tell me if you disagree if this isn't spot on to what David was just talking about. And well, I'll just play it anyway because I love Tool off of the album 10,000 Days. I'm gonna take this little break. You're listening to Head On with Bob Kincaid. I am your guest host, John Fox. And we will return after this.
Tool. Tonight's final hour of Head On begins next. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to Head On with Bob Kincaid. I am your guest host, John Fox. And, yeah, I know I hit you with a bit of something very, very heavy there going out of the last hour, but I think it, you know, Maynard James Keenan, sorry, he's one of my favorites. He's a musical hero of mine. And also one of the most socially conscious lyricists of the modern era, I reckon. And I actually, you know, I sent the lyrics into the chat room, and I don't know if anybody had a look, but I want to read a bit of this to you because I think it speaks very much to what David was talking about on the phone just before. So we're going to take phone calls in a minute, but just hold on before you ring in. Just let me do this because, you know, and for the Malloy audience, I apologize for a bit of the pop culture stuff at the beginning of the hour or the beginning of the show. But for those of you who aren't familiar with me, I was a touring audio engineer, played in bands for years. I've seen most of the Australian continent from either a Tarago or a semi-trailer. And music is important to me. And socially conscious music, unfortunately, in our modern era, gets shunned. You know, we don't want people thinking. And, you know, David was speaking about this. Now, the track that I played is off of an album called 10,000 Days. It's the most recent Tool release. And, yeah, I am a fanatic about Tool. I will totally admit it. But, I mean, the opening lyric of this, "Eye on the TV, because tragedy thrills me. Whatever flavor it happens to be, like, killed by the husband, drowned by the ocean, shot by his own son, she used a poison in his tea, kissed him goodbye. That's mine of kind of story. It's no fun till someone dies. Don't look at me like I am a monster. Frown out your one face, but with the other, stare like a junkie into the TV, stare like a zombie. While the mother holds her child, watches them die, hands to the sky crying, why oh why? Because I need to watch things die from a distance. Vicariously I live while the whole world dies. All you need it to, don't lie. Why can't we just admit it? And yes, Frank and Angel, I dig Nine Inch Nails too. And, Tool came from Nine Inch Nails? No, I'll disagree with that one. Actually, A Perfect Circle was a bit of one of Nine Inch Nails' guitar techs getting Maynard on board. But they are part of a community. Actually, Maynard was the bass player for really silly band, something Jello. I can't remember the name of it, and they actually had to change their name to something Jelly. I can't remember now, because, well, the Jello Corporation went after them. But I think David hit on a really great point here. You know, and is it the extension of what bleeds leads? And Green Jello, thank you, David. I couldn't think of it. But, yeah, if I'm not mistaken, Maynard was the bass player in that band. Oh, okay. All right. Well, if I've got that wrong about the Nine Inch Nails connection, I apologize. But, as far as a thought-provoking band, Tool is absolutely one of my favorites. And Trent Reznor is another guy who is turning the music industry on its head by shunning the label system and actually really, really, really pissing off his record label. And to be able to create music for music's sake. And, you know, this, you know,
We have so much media coming at us, and like, you know, we've had it confirmed, like, that whole Goldblum thing was a hoax, okay? And, you know, someone said, you know, well, that's the internet's for you. Well, but that's not necessarily true. We've had plenty of hoaxes in the past, and with the beauty of the internet is the fact that it can be corrected just as fast as the wrong information came out. So, you know, nothing changes, really. It's just kind of the speed at which it happens. But, you know, this track, I think, speaks very, very much to this situation of, you know, people just glued to 24-hour news waiting to see some death and destruction. I mean, it's like, why do people go to NASCAR? They don't go to see who's going to win the bloody race. They're hoping for a wreck. Yeah, Angry Architect is talking about Trent and his whole rage here in Australia against his record label. And my good friend Scott Berry was doing monitors on that tour. And he rang me up even before the stories came out. He's like, oh, man, he said, it was a thing of beauty here. You know, and Trent came to Australia. He's got a huge following here. He's got a really dedicated fan base. And Trent hasn't made a dime off of one of his albums in years. He makes his money off of touring and off of the members area of his site. And he promotes his fans to actually remix and recut his music and then resubmit it. And, you know, he gives his listeners the benefit of the doubt of being intelligent. And when he was down here, he saw that, you know, one of the Pop Princess's albums, you know, was, you know, on special for like $17, but yet his album was still $32. So he asked the record label, you know, what the hell's going on with this? And I said, well, your audience is dedicated. They'll pay it. And he says this to his audience. And he says, you know, he said, you know, this is what my record label thinks of you. And so a couple months later, he comes back to the very same venue on another trip with virtually the same exact audience and asks, has the price of my album come down yet? And the whole crowd says, nope. And he goes, steal it. Then just go ahead and steal it. And this is in a small part, in a small way, a sign of the media machine and what they think of the public. It's about manipulation. And it's really tragic. It's really tragic. You know, and I've said it before, the music industry screaming about how downloads are killing their business, sorry, releasing crap is what has been killing your profits. I think it's the bottom line. You keep releasing crap and promoting crap. And why a band like Tool is such a great example. You know, 5-6 years between albums. They refuse to do an iTunes deal because you don't buy songs. You buy the entire body of work. A signpost, a snapshot of where the artist was at this time. And so Tool then gives a complete package with wonderful artwork and packaging that makes people want to go and buy it. And I watch here, you know, in Australia, about the week before a new Tool album comes out, late at night, they put a couple of little ads up. Very simple ads, just like going, oh, hi, by the way, there's a new Tool album. And that thing goes platinum in the matter of days. And you go back to, you know, days past in the music industry where the album being released was the advertising for the tour. Right? And then the money was made on touring All of that. Angry Architect's talking about his old EP. Who did you play with, Angry? He's saying the old EP is still on sale at Big W, but he doesn't know where the money's going, and it ain't going to him. And that's not a surprise. But, I mean, you know, all the uncertainty over, like, all the citizen reporting that's going on in Iran, you know, is this feeding, again, this, you know, this vicarious observation and drinking up of death? Ha! Line driver, no kidding. Ha! No way. All right. Okay. Had no idea, man. All right. Okay. I do actually have a vague remembrance. I'll have to go and look it up, Mr. Angry, and remember. Pardon me. But the phone lines are open again. 304-574-7811. 304-574-7811. Bring in. What do you think of all this? You know, were you ready to tune out once you heard the third Michael Jackson song? Wow. You know, when you start a show, you just never know where it's going to go. And it's one of the things that I love about doing this. And it's one of the things that I love about this network of ours. That, you know, it's not run by producers and whatnot. Kind of wish that we had more in the way of producers, because self-production and trying to maintain a train of thought while queuing up music and doing other things can be a bit of a drag. But you know what? Our listeners are our producers half the time. They tell us. You guys tell us what you want to talk about. What you want to hear, you know? I said yesterday how I've been on a little bit of a Bill Hicks kind of run. I've been kind of going back and catching up on him. And, you know, I was watching an interview with him from Austin Public Access. And, you know, and this was back in the 90s where he said that, you know, the people have lost their voice of reason. You know, you have all this mass media out there saying one thing. And you have people of reason, you know, not having any way to get their thoughts, their opinions out. And, you know, this was all during the censorship time when he was dealing with the stuff with David Letterman. And he talked about how, you know, what he did as a comic, and actually ended up being much more of a social commentator, that there were so few voices out there, and people didn't want him in the mainstream. Because he spoke too much truth, and he spoke too much to what people felt. And, you know, I've thought many, 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 many times that, you know, his was a voice that's been very, very missed through the last decade. You know? Could you imagine? You know, there was, you know, he did some great stuff about the Persian Gulf War, you know, and I remember I watched one of his London or one of his UK TV specials, and you know, he was talking about the Persian Gulf War, and it was so funny. It was just like the lead up to the Iraq War, where Saddam and Iraq have all these horrible weapons, all these horrible weapons. Well, how did you know? And, you know, it's like, well, we looked at the receipt. You know, and because we sold it to him. And
And he goes off on this great tirade. You know, I'm really, really sick of the United States going and arming all these little nations, and then we have to go in and kick their ass. And the only time that it seems that the public pays any attention is when the death starts. And then we all get up and we cheerlead. Hey, look at, we got to watch that missile go straight down the chimney! Isn't that awesome? Like a damn video game! Drives me crazy. And, you know, and it's like so much, nothing has changed. Absolutely nothing has changed. And it's, aside from being frightening, it's tragic. You know, and for all the anger that Hicks displayed, you know, he always seemed to end, all the footage that I've seen, he always seemed to end his shows with this thing saying, you know, if we took the money that we spend on defense every year, we could feed, clothe, and educate every human on the planet many times over. And no one would be left out. And we could, and we as a people could explore outer space and inner space together. And for all of his aggression, and this is where I relate to the guy so much, for all of his aggression and his anger, he was a peaceful guy. He just wanted people to love each other, for fuck's sake. And you can find on Google Video, you can find his two London or English major TV appearances that were aired in prime time, unedited. You know, this is the other thing about American media that just I find just so pathetic. Ever since I've lived here, just like on this network where we can freely use the entire vocabulary, and sometimes the brown words are the most effective. There's no problem with saying these things in primetime television here. Because this is what people say. This is how, you know, if it's fucked, it's fucked. And, you know, I do find it really funny. There's a really great program here called Good News Week. It's a very funny comedy panel show. And if you have a search, you probably can I'm not sure if it's syndicated internationally or not, but at the 10 network here, or just look up Good News Week. And you know, they have their regular hosts and team captains, but then they always have, you know, local and international comics and whatnot on as guests. And I always find it really funny when they have Americans on who have never been down here before and suddenly hear, you know, shit, fuck, goddamn, all that for primetime television. And you just see these people just, you know, going, you can say that here? And they'll just be completely gobsmacked, not knowing how to handle it. And it's like, that's the conditioning. And by limiting people's language and the words that they're able to use, it ends up being, in a way, it is censorship. And, you know, it seems trivial. But things like comedy are supposed to be edgy. Otherwise, it's worthless. You know, even Hicks had moments where he kind of objectified women a little bit, and it would make me cringe. But that's okay. Comedy is supposed to be risky. And if it's not, it's just garbage. Phone line's still open, folks. 304-574-7811. 304-574-7811. I'd love to get a couple more calls in before we get out of here today. But, you know, I hadn't quite really thought about this whole Iran thing and the way that it's being followed and the way that we are watching it in light of, say, this song Vicarious. I really hadn't. And now you know, David talked about the fact that, you know, we've had one martyr already. And the news cycle lifespan on that martyr will run its course, and it's already starting to run its course. And when it dies out, we're going to end up needing to have another martyr to keep, you know, the intensity of the whole storyline going. You know, Lilo in the chat room says, you know, I'd rather settle for good old-fashioned news reporting without that many gas bags. I agree. I absolutely agree. Yeah, we miss Murrow and Walter Cronkite and you know, and even in those days they were dealing with the corporate influence, but there was this you know, level of standard to journalism. And I think the Vietnam War changed all that. You know, having brought the reality of American imperialism into everyone's living room ended up, it was never going to happen again. You know, every war after that, you know, reporters weren't really allowed on the ground. And then, so then to deal with that, we ended up with embedded reporters. Remember that? Remember the embedded reporters? You know, the guys riding the tanks and they're going, "Hey, ain't this cool? We're heading into Baghdad! This is just massive! This is just so cool! I'm riding with the army! This is a first-hand account!" Yeah, but it's a biased first-hand account. Oh, I think I need to take a quick little musical interlude here. And hopefully we'll get maybe a call in before we get out of here. Starting to get a headache. I'm kind of getting so... Yeah. Lilo, well put, man. Embedded sounds too much like in bed with them. Very good. Maybe if we end up going through this again, that's, you know, just as we call it the for-profit media, we can call them in bed with them reporters. I think that is a great idea. Oh, okay. We got a call. Hold on a second. Welcome to Head On. Who we got?
Hi, this is Preston in Denver.
Hey, Preston, how are you, man?
Doing all right. Who's this?
This is John Fox.
Oh, hey, man. I'm sorry. I just kind of walked in the door and just turned it on and wanted to give you a call and say hey.
Hey, heard some crazy guy ranting. Bob's in D.C. for the next couple of days, so I'm kind of covering things. I haven't been on in a while. I usually do a show on Sunday nights, but I've been kind of off air for a little while due to technical issues, and I didn't want Bob to go without having his show on while he's in D.C. Checking out these hearings. But what can we do for you, my friend? Love when you call into Bob.
Well, thanks. And actually, I'm glad I caught you, so I have a chance to thank you for all the good work you do to help make Bob's show happen. We owe you a debt of gratitude for sure, so thank you.
Thank you, man. It's my pleasure. This whole thing's a labor of love, and this is my extended family.
Right on. One comment I wanted to make regarding Iran and what's going on there. Certainly, I'm in solidarity with the authentic elements of the popular movement for
right.
some more, you know, liberal reforms and that kind of thing. But, you know, certainly we need to, you know, be watchful for the ways in which, you know, the CIA or the National Endowment for Democracy, so-called, the ways in which they can sometimes manipulate people and co-opt popular movements.
This is like the thing that's constantly in the back of my mind while watching this. I can never get out of my head the concept that I never know what our covert agencies might be up to in the midst of this, and I'm always suspect.
Sure. I was kind of surprised today. I think it was on Common Dreams, that website. Norman Solomon wrote a piece, and I like Norman Solomon a lot. He's worked for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, written a couple books. But he wrote a book basically calling Hugo Chavez an idiot for he was kind of being supportive of Ahmadinejad. Certainly there are lots of criticisms of him, but there are a few things that I think he can be appreciated for. I'd even go that far. I mean, he's not, you know, he has some good points.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
For example, he's actually working with Venezuela and other countries to try to form a sort of a different sort of economic bloc, do their own sort of trade instead of having the World Bank and the World Trade Organization dictate what their country is going to be like and what sort of economic system they have and who they're going to trade with and on and on and on.
Oh, yeah.
So they're standing up to that. Lots of other issues. But apparently, you know, there was that poll that indicated that he did have a 2-to-1 advantage to the opposition candidate. I think that's a significant, you know, detail. And, you know, additionally, you know, for Norman Solomon to criticize Chavez for saying something like, you know, we should respect the vote and calling him an idiot for it amazes me, because in 2002, Hugo Chavez had something very similar happen to him.
Oh,
he
yeah.
won. He won that popular vote. It was verified by the Organization of American States. It was verified by the Carter Center, many other groups, that it was a legitimate vote. Chavez won. In 2002, the U.S., through the CIA and the National Endowment for Democracy, helped stage an attempted coup that removed him from office for 3 days, shut down the Supreme Court, canceled the Constitution.
I remember that.
And the beautiful... And so I think Chavez has every reason to say the sort of things he's saying. If Norman Solomon to call him an idiot, I think that's kind of idiotic on Solomon's part.
Yeah.
Very disappointing. But people responded on the website and pointed these things out to him on Common Dreams. But again, the beautiful thing about what happened in Venezuela that year was that the popular support, the authentic popular support for Chavez showed up in the streets. Poor people came down, poured down from the hills where a lot of the slums are,
yep.
filled the streets, marched to their Capitol building, and it so frightened the elite that they said, bring him back, or these people are going to burn down our neighborhoods. They did.
Absolutely. Is it The Revolution Will Not Be Televised? Actually,
there you go.
A really, really good documentary on that time in history. And
yep.
I've got a friend of mine here in Australia, a guy by the name of Rodrigo, who did his political doctorate thesis on Latin America. And he went over and interviewed Chavez and virtually all of the leaders in that area. And, you know, I was working on a lecture series a few years back that we actually used to rebroadcast here on the Horn.
Oh, wow.
But it was a really, really good thing. I even got to be part of an interview with Robert Fisk during that time, which is still one of the highlights that I've ever had.
Great.
I mean, there is a true foreign correspondent. And I used to talk to Rodrigo a fair bit, and I'm hoping he's going to actually start blogging sometime very soon, because he's a brilliant writer. And he, you know, I'm always of such a mixed view of Chavez. Because, I mean, there are things that he's done. Like, first of all, I think nationalizing the oil and letting the people's oil actually benefit the people is a very honorable thing to do. And there are other things that he did that I think were just amazing. You know, he's educated all these doctors and invited medical students and given them scholarships from other bordering nations and educated them and then sent them home, right? And this idea of trying to do good for the poorest amongst his people, I think he's done really, really well. Now, when I see him do these things like trying to change the term limits and things like that, it worries me. But what Rodrigo would say to me, he said, but this is the issue. He said, I know that that's how it looks, but he said to the people on the ground, the most of the population, there is at the moment no one else but him that has the spine to stand up to the white upper class, and they are fine with this because without him, they feel it'll all go away.
Yeah, and it does take spine to do that. I mean, he's very familiar with the history in Latin America, you know, with people doing his sort of thing, you know, being, you know, the economic hitmen moving in and then the jackals and all that stuff. So, yeah, definitely. And that RCTV controversy when he pulled the he did not renew the license for that corporate channel.
Yeah.
That was portrayed here as, you know, he's taken over the media, no dissent is allowed, no opposition at all, which is a complete deception. There's opposition all over their media. That particular channel, you know, they were actually involved with that coup attempt.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
If NBC or Fox News had been involved with, say, a coup attempt against Obama and had taken him away for 3 days and shut down the Supreme Court and did all that stuff, it wouldn't have been a matter if the people had retaken control in such a circumstance. The issue would not have been whether NBC or Fox would have had their charters revoked. They would have been probably executed for treason.
Yeah.
So Chavez, what he did actually was quite a moderate approach. Their license was up. He revoked it. And what they did with it was basically hand it over to people. They go out in the street, put cameras on people, say if they're at a strike or if there's a teacher's meeting or if it's just vendors, street vendors on the street. They'll give them the camera and a mic and be like, what's on your mind?
Yeah.
All kinds of opposition voices as well, but a lot of people are just trying to, you know, advocate for whatever interest. If they want a literacy group, or I went to Caracas actually a few years ago, and I met with some of those people who are organizing health circles and education, and you know, they provide food for impoverished people. They have forums for art, and they actually had an international gathering of corn growers get together at the park and talk about the issues. Yeah, talk about issues like their food traditions, their food, and their food safety concerns. They're very concerned about genetically modified.
Modified corn, even though it's illegal, you know, from Mexico south, from American products that get shipped over, someone, you know, a little bit drops out, it ends up germinating, and you end up with this cross-pollinating, and you have all these people that have been, you know, holding on to and maintaining these ancient strains of corn that are now under threat because of the GM products that are out there now. And so, you know, what right, GM is actually an issue that I've ranted on about in my show to great length, because my show is environment and music normally.
Because,
you know, the rest of the boys do so much of the U.S. politics stuff that, you know, gotta do something else a little bit. And those are probably my two biggest passions. Most of my working life has been in the entertainment industry, you know, touring engineer, played in bands, you know, been a drum and guitar tech and all of that kind of thing, been a tour manager, and, you know, I always did it for getting the music out. And then the other thing is, you know, what we're doing to this planet that sustains us just really, it sometimes drives me to the point of tears.
Yeah, definitely.
You know,
definitely.
It's really interesting. You know, you were talking about Chavez and the way that he's portrayed. You know, and he does that. He does the I think it's once a week. He has his little TV appearances. You know, and he like and he like sings and stuff. You know, and he gets portrayed as being like this nutter. But the impression that I've gotten from Rodrigo and some other people is no, this is him being part of the culture.
Yeah.
And the people love it because he's actually showing himself to be much more one of them than of the elite. And there's a lot to be said for that. You know, it shows him to be very human. And I don't think, as far as I've been able to get, it's very real, which is something that we don't get out of our politicians.
You're right. Although it's fun to hear things like Obama being such a fan of the conscious rap music. I don't know if he's actually done some rap himself, but, you know, that sort of humanizing thing and showing an appreciation of culture. Is great, you know, culture beyond John Wayne movies and stuff like that. You bet. And Chavez, there was a Frontline piece on him that was a kind of a mix. And towards the end, it was more critical. They talked about some former allies who now thought he was, you know, doing a lot of missteps and was becoming very combative. And, you know, but that's that opinion, and they had their agenda to frame things a particular way. You know, Frontline can be hit and miss. But I think a film like The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, what you mentioned, shows that, that what's going on there is also much more than Chavez. You know, there's those hundreds of thousands of millions of supporters who will get in the streets if they're pushed, making Chavez, you know, giving him some solidarity and help, crucial assists. And there's international solidarity going on that's very important. There's the deals that the Chavez administration did to trade their oil wealth, you know, with Cuba, and Cuba sends some of their trained healthcare professionals to help them out in impoverished sections and educate people. Cuba, by the way, has just a phenomenal healthcare system.
Oh, yeah.
That they, and they actually send their doctors and nurses to Africa and other parts of Latin America. They've helped out all over the world. They're bringing some poor Black and Native American people to Cuban medical schools, like the University of Havana.
Right.
So, I mean, they call it a, what do they call it? It's a citizen, it's a different sort of, you know, diplomacy, citizen diplomacy.
Right. Well, yeah. And you know, Chavez also offered heating oil to the United States at a reduced rate when the international cartels were running the prices up. And, you know, and George W. Bush is like, hell no, we don't need none of that, Earl. You know.
And, discount, what?
Yeah, and it's just like, you know, people are hurting. Help them.
Yeah, that's too radical an idea.
Yeah, this is where, you know, you might have caught on that I was saying that just recently over the last week I've kind of been going on a little bit of a Bill Hicks kind of reconnection.
Okay.
And it's amazing, you know, for how angry he was always portrayed. It was always out of this idea that we don't love each other love one another enough.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually the rage was just the manifestation of frustration. I really, really miss not having his voice. I mean, I just can only imagine what he'd be ranting about today. You know, him and John Lennon, you know, it's just like, you know, we need them.
But, you know, you're right. And in some ways, their spirit kind of revisits us here and there. I heard that there's going to be a documentary about Hicks coming out in the near future. And a couple of years ago, a wonderful documentary about Lennon came out. I think it was called The U.S. versus John Lennon.
Oh, fantastic film.
Yep. So in these ways, their spirit carries on. And also, there's always other people around kind of popping up that are not the same but similar figures doing similar kind of work. I'm sure there's a comedian out there that's letting it rip and that we haven't discovered yet that's working some bars somewhere. And John Lennon's style musician. I don't know. It's hard to match, but I must say I love Sam Beam of Iron and Wine a lot. It's not quite as explicitly political as often, but it's so beautiful. It's subversive, I think.
Yeah.
And it,
Michael Franti and Spearhead.
There you go.
I mean, if there was anybody modern that kind of like sings my politics, that's it, man. And you know, I play very often this track, and I won't have time to get to it tonight, but there's a great track off of an Australian-only release called Stay Human.
Yeah.
And it absolutely, I think, speaks to everything that's kind of wrong and that we've forgotten our humanity.
Yeah, we've been indoctrinated in so many ways that we're encouraged to forget our humanity and drop it because that's silly. It's a dog-eat-dog world and all that kind of stuff. You know, we're very much indoctrinated in a kind of mafioso view of the world. Mm-hmm. I think that's why we are constantly getting these, you know, good fellows and stuff like that. They carry an attitudinal teaching going on there, which I think is incredibly reactionary and brutal. And it's a reflection of much of our U.S. foreign policy. Just right now, I'm reading this story about, a paramilitary thug with a long history, worked with top Democrats, and what they would say is, well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And, you know, kinds of lines that I'm sure the Nazis used to rationalize their own pathological violence. People like Franti are the opposite of that and encourage us to remember our humanity.
Have you ever seen his documentary, I Know I'm Not Alone?
Haven't seen that, no.
It's on Google Video. Check it out. It's really amazing because it's just him, his producer, and a camera and an audio guy. And this barefooted guy with his guitar goes to Iraq, he goes to Afghanistan, he goes to the wall between Palestine and Israel.
Wow.
And with nothing else but his beautiful smile, his energy, and his guitar, he ends up getting into places that, like, nobody gets into. And there's even one scene where he actually gets the guards, the Israeli guards, and some local Palestinians to actually sit down and talk and start to see one another for their similarities as opposed to their differences. And he does this thing where he says, you know, he knew he wasn't going to, he'd never be able to, you know, learn any Arabic or Farsi or anything enough to be able to write a song. And he knew that, you know, writing something in English there wasn't going to really have the effect that he wanted. So he was looking for like a word. And he was introduced to the word Habibi, which means loved one. And it not necessarily meaning like your wife or your girlfriend or your boyfriend. It's just, you know, it can be anyone, like, you know, the way that we use the term, you know, my brother in a pluralistic form. And there are these moments where he's walking through Iraq, you know, and the war's going on, and he just starts bashing this G chord, just going, Habibi, Habibi. And the kids just start to fall out and following him like the minstrel and they're all sitting there going, Habibi, ha, and this ended up being like his master key into everything.
Wow.
It's just
amazing.
Absolutely, I've watched it numerous times, and it never ceases to make me feel better.
I'll definitely check that out. That's I Know I'm Not Alone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Google Video.
Yeah, yeah, you'll be able to find it, and it's just a really, because I find him an amazing guy, and he is multiculturalism in one body. You know,
that's true.
It's just a wonderful thing. Hey, man, this has been
one last comment.
Yes, please. Yeah, yeah, I got a couple minutes.
Okay, back to Chavez and popular movements and stuff. Remember, it's beyond Chavez. He's working in alliance with people like Evo Morales in Bolivia, Rafael Correa in Ecuador. One kind of holdout in the region, or one movement that needs to take place in the political realm, is what's going on certainly in Colombia, but also Peru. Their president, Alan Garcia, is very much, you know, obedient to the West, is pushing neoliberal economics, you know, corporate fundamentalism. And, you know, speaking of green revolutions and state repression and people that we should be standing in solidarity with who are working towards justice, the Peruvian people, the indigenous people, the campesinos. Recently, you know, dozens of them were killed because they're standing up against the oil companies and the mining companies that are trying to move into the Amazon. And the result, though, I mean, it was tragic that there was so much bloodshed recently, but they were successful in getting a couple of the neoliberal decrees revoked that was selling off, big chunks of the Amazon. So remember those people. You know, see how we're not getting the same footage. You know, the Iranian footage, you know, we're getting that covered. We're getting our focus put on that. And, you know, we should be aware. We should be aware from a variety of sources and independent journalists, stuff like that. But yeah. Peru is largely being marginalized, ignored. Very intentionally.
Oh yeah, if you're not covering it, you can go and meddle much more. You know, they can just kind of freely go and try and meddle, and so yeah, it's always that thing where you have to always go. But yeah, what am I not being told?
That's right. I think Orwell said something about deception, going beyond lying. It's often omissions, deceit by omission. So, keep an eye on what's going on in Peru. And I guess that's about it, man. I really enjoyed, getting to speak with you directly.
Right on, man.
Did we catch each other once a while back?
You met. I think we have actually had a chat once before. I cannot recall when.
Okay.
But you're one of my favorite callers in the Bob Show. Your energy is just kind of so peaceful and balanced. You're not quite as like ragey and crazy as I am, and you always bring something really thought provoking. My Mrs. Gail loves when you're on. Because she'll be listening from her job right now, and she'll mention it. And actually, I have to tell you, Frank and Angel says hello from the chat room.
I was just thinking of her. I received I need to get in touch with her, actually. But when's your show on?
I'll be back on Sunday night, 9 to midnight. It'll be my first show back in a while, just due to technical problems and dead computers.
That's Eastern time, right?
Yes.
9 to midnight?
Yes.
Okay. Just making a note.
No worries, man. I'm gonna have to let you go because I'm just about on the end of things and Malloy's coming up. So thanks for ringing in, man. It's a real pleasure.
Likewise. You bet.
All right, man. You take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. And that was our friend Preston, and we're going to have to get out of here because we're coming up. We're running out of time. Malloy's coming up, as you all know. And to the Malloy listeners that will be hearing this in replay, thanks for dealing with all the pop culture crap today. it was that kind of day. But we got back on track. It ended up, via David. Thank you for turning all that back to where we need to be paying attention. And where is it? There it is. And thanks to Ben Birch at the White Rose Society. Thanks to everybody. Thanks to the mods and the bloggers and everybody for helping out today. And as always, RMR, it's all for you. And it'll play here in a second. Bloody media player. It's coming. I promise. Come on. Come on. Come on. I'm going to have to figure out what this is doing. Because this is frustrating. 30 seconds to get a track to play? Here we go. RMR, it's all for you. We'll see you guys tomorrow. Thanks for being here. This has been great, great fun. Come on. You can do it. You can do it. You can do it.
You're listening to The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network.
I James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life! Life, you hear me? Is my creation! Life!
So this was fun.
You're gonna like me.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
You count them.
Six. Five, four, three, two, one.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast.
My fellow
Americans,
ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The whole world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Guy James Show. Glad to have all of you along with us this afternoon, wherever you are, all around the world and all across this beautiful country of ours. Welcome to the Guy James Show. It's an honor to have you with us today. No storms here today. How great is that? Usually we get them this time of afternoon. And today, everything looks reasonably well, I think. So we're in for a good afternoon. I better turn my headphones up so I can hear myself. There we go. Once again, the staff is off today. We've laid the staff off for the summer. So it's just going to be me, the producer and writers and director and board op and all that. They're all going to be off for the entire summer. They're vacationing in Argentina. That's what they said. They said they were going to go hiking or some of them said they were going to go to Argentina. What? Well, that's what they said. Some of them said they were going to go hiking on the Appalachian Trail and some of them said they were going to go to Argentina. Why would I doubt anybody? Why would anybody tell anybody a story like that? Never mind. I don't think people believe my staff, and that really bothers me, that someone would think my staff would, lie to me. Certainly they wouldn't. Nobody would do that. They wouldn't tell you they were going hiking and not be going hiking. I saw one of them's car had sleeping bags and tents and everything else in it. I saw it myself. Really, I did. Sad news today, a couple of hours ago, I suppose, right around there, we find out about the death of Farrah Fawcett. Certainly an icon in showbiz, and what a beautiful gal she was, and from all indications, what a nice personality she had as well. A lot of people loved Sarah Fawcett and followed Sarah Fawcett and Farrah Fawcett and kept track of her terrible disease and the fight she put up for the last couple of years. So Farrah Fawcett is no more, but she will always be remembered, particularly by a lot of young men who had that big poster up on their wall in the college dorms and all that when she was on, Charlie's Angels show. 62 years old, gone, and it's a shame. If you hear any weird noises in the background, the landscaping crew around here is giving all the palm trees today what we call here in Florida the hurricane cut. We usually wait a few weeks into the hurricane season and then cut the palm trees. They're half naked now. They cut a lot of the fronds off so that if a hurricane does hit, there won't be so much wind resistance with, you know, too many branches, too many fronds, as we call them, to knock the trees over. It helps in that respect, and it also helps from all the debris. So all of our palm trees here at the Guy James Show studio, I believe 23 of them, are getting their hair cut, their yearly hurricane cut, as we call it today. So if you hear a chainsaw in the background, you'll know what's happening. And unfortunately, one of the trees has succumbed to some sort of a disease. Don't know what it is. They get little mushroom things like growing on the side, and you know they're done for when they get that. They get this disease. So one of the trees has to go, but we're planting a new one. Can't let the studios not look good, you know. 866-546-5254 if you'd like to join us on the program today. We have a very interesting program for you today, I believe. Coming up in the second hour, right after the news at the top of the hour, we're expecting a call from Representative John Yarmuth from the 3rd District of Kentucky. And he is going to talk to us about health care and how that's proceeding in the United States Congress. I also want to congratulate him, and we'll tell him when he calls, for sponsoring that credit card bill of rights that went to the president's desk not so long ago. And then at 4:30, we've got a rather unusual guest. Some of you may remember at the Democratic Convention last year, what was it, August, I guess, when I was in Denver, I interviewed a gal by the name of Martha Zoller. Martha Zoller. Perhaps you saw her on CNN the other night. She's a popular conservative talk show host from Atlanta. Nice gal. She stayed at the same bed and breakfast where I stayed at, and we actually had a Chinese dinner together one evening talking about politics. Very nice gal. She is, like I said, a conservative talk show host from Atlanta, the Atlanta area. She's on around 10 stations around Georgia, I think it is, and we have her on to talk about the Mark Sanford mess. And before I go too far, I do want to update you, let you know, and pass it on, tell your neighbor, tell everybody you know that Bob Kincaid is, as we speak, in the Hart Senate Office Building in Washington, D.C., attending the mountaintop removal hearings conducted by Ben Cardin, I believe. So you will want to watch the news tonight to see possibly Bob Kincaid being hauled out of the Hart Senate Office Building in shackles. It could happen. It could happen. Bob is a real revolutionary type guy. And you've seen him. You've seen that picture of him. All of him when he's in his overcoat. He won't have that on today. But remember that picture I took of him in Washington, D.C.? Have all of you seen that? The Capitol building's over his shoulder, and he's got that hat on and his sunglasses and an overcoat. And I think one of them, one of the pictures is with Senator Sherrod Brown. But there's another one of Bob standing there by his side. He looks so serious, you know. He looks like the kind of guy that, you know, if he got in the Hart Senate Office Building hearing and they said things that didn't suit him, Bob would stand up and say something. So expect him to get arrested tonight. He called me a couple of hours ago and told me where he's at and what he's doing. And I said, Bob, there's one thing I want to know, the most important thing of all of this to me, and I know it's selfish, is, Bob, are you going to dine at Fogo de Chao, that beef bonanza place on Pennsylvania Avenue tonight? Because he said he might, and he said if he did it, he would do it in